Well, Richard said he hadn't done much yam in a while. He hadn't done any even a longer while. So I managed to make a talk with absolutely no data. And the idea is really to bring up some questions, some of which Richard has brought up, and so some of them will be the same and some will be different. What I was charged to do, and I probably shouldn't have paid attention, I just done what I wanted to do, but I'm too much of a straight arrow. So it's to talk about the mathematical and technical challenges. So these are, I think, to raise questions. So let's just begin. Well, what are the goals? What do people want out of the EM? And I think what people want is a 3D map that can yield an atomic model with a known accuracy, so you actually know how well your model obeys reality. And you want to visualize conformational variability. It's one of the issues is, of course, we'll get to it. The other thing, of course, people now want are, they want tomograms of cells in which you can identify, sort, and average pieces of cell machinery at molecular resolution or better. I think it's what Richard was referring to. And finally, I think we want total automation, at least I do, so that anyone with a structural question can sort of come in and get a three-dimensional map, much as the way people use the light microscope. And in talking with people, I've sort of become interested in it. Most of them have absolutely no idea how the light microscope works. But you just put your slide in, and you get all these nice fluorescent pictures. And I think it'd be very nice if people could do that. X-ray diffraction has become quite a mature thing, and you really don't have to know very much about it to get an atomic model. So I think this is something we should aspire to. And it should have all of the problems that Richard was pointing out should all be taken care of so that you, the user, you know, won't have to come to a course like this. You'll just show up at some, and anyway. So I thought we'd begin with a list of things that need improvement. And so here's my list of things that need improvement. So I thought, well, maybe we should make a list of the things that don't need improvement. So here's the list of things that don't need improvement, right? And I think it's fair to say that that given that everything needs work, are there one or two real bottlenecks? And I think the answer is not. I mean, and the answer is we have to, I think, nickel and dime the problem. We need to bring lots of change if we're going to do that. Lots of change, sort of a play on words, pulling, not that amusing, but I liked it. Okay, thank you. Well, the first thing is, of course, better specimens. That's sort of duh. I mean, everybody knows that. The other thing, one of the issues that comes up is, the question is, when you have a field of single particles, or even if they're 1.5-dimensional crystals like helices or something else, I mean, these things are flexible. And there's no reason to suppose that in your field they're really all in the same conformation. That's probably not true. And it would be good. I mean, the conformational variations are interesting. They're biologically interesting. They're important. If you think conformational variation isn't important, freeze your enzyme and then try and run an enzymatic reaction. And you'll find out that movement is essential for living things. So these conformational variations are important. We'd like to image them. And if we could control them so that we could have something just in one, you know, state, I think that would be a very good thing. Of course, for people doing tomography, they'd like ribbons of undistorted frozen hydrated sections from well-preserved examples screened and analyzed first by cryo-light microscopy so that you can, in fact, see where interesting regions are, is going to have to look at the whole cell. If you ever counted the number of sections you have to cut through a good-sized cell, you'll realize that localizing what it is you want to look at will really pay off. And the other thing I thought might be helpful is to have an embedding medium that conducts. And that might sound a little bit odd, but Joe Wall has some ideas about this that might prove to be entertaining. And again, I'm just raising things that would be nice to have. I don't know if they exist, but that wasn't in the instructions. That Bridget and Ron didn't say, think of only things that exist and are possible. So, but better films to put over the grids, and I mean, we all make them of one kind or another, or buy them. So you want them to be flat, you want them to be stiff, you want them to be sturdy, you want patterned holes for reasons that you will find out later, and you want the films to be non-stick. That is, you don't want your particles stuck. You want them in the hole, not stuck to the surface. You don't want them to stick. I don't know how you make one that doesn't do that, but it's something to think about, something to wish for, and it'll be different for different samples. You would also like them to be conductive at very low temperatures, liquid helium, for example. And carbon is not particularly good that way. Here I mention the Joe Wall proposed use of polypyrrole films, which are strong, conduct well at liquid nitrogen, apparently. And there's a reference there. So there may be other substances we really haven't explored that will help this problem with charging. And one of the things Joe had suggested is you can make this into fibers, and so you could think about running fibers around your specimen maybe to take some of the charge away. I think it's an area that people haven't really explored as much as they might. Maybe things won't work, I don't know, but if you don't try, you don't know. Lou Tilney always says you don't know what you don't know. It sounds sort of cyclical, but it's actually quite profound if you think about it. At least it was to me. The other thing you'd really like is a clonable heavy metal label for EM, the analog of GFP. That is, one of the things that when you get a structure, it doesn't tell you which part of the protein or RNA is in which lump. And you'd really like to know that. So when you have a tomogram or something, you'd like to know where your structure of interest is. And so you'd like a clonable heavy metal label. And of course, there are labels now. You can't always get them into an intact cell. So that's a problem. And even when you permeabilize the cell, sometimes the labeling efficiency is pretty lousy. So you see maybe 5, 10%, 15%. Of the particles get labeled, or the tags, and you really like something where you can clone on a label and it's irresistible. This is one of the things. That we did a little bit of work on. You like a protein tag upon which you can grow a gold cluster atom by atom, and of course the reason for that is that when you grow something atom by atom, it's almost irresistible. That is, there's no such thing as steric hindrance. It's very hard to have steric hindrance when you're putting in single atoms. It's very tiny. And then you can grow a big gold cluster, of course, and may tear your structure apart. But nonetheless, it'll be labeled. And so the idea is you can label every single tag you put on the same way you can with GFP. And Chris Mercogliano and I explored the use of metallothionine. And it shows promise, but it still needs development. So if any of you are interested, please do think about it. Now, metallothionine here, there are the papers right there. It's a small molecule that has about 60 amino acids, 20 of which are cysteine. And here it is binding some metal atoms. And so it has two sort of domains. And what you can show is that it will bind quite a wide range of metals, including, of course, everyone's favorite gold, but also silver, mercury, cadmium, copper, So it'll bind a wide range of things, including zinc. And zinc is here. And so we've, when we've been using it, we've made it with zinc attached. And then the good news is that whatever else you have up here, copper, iron, or something, gold will displace them. And it's very stable once you've done that. So it does bind gold. And here's some examples of MALDI mass spec that Chris did. Here's metallothionein. And here's a sample where he got 33 bound gold atoms. That's the peak, but you can see it skews out to a heavier mass, and out here you have something like about 40 gold atoms bound to one metallothionein molecule. And this peak out here is just it's a dimer of metallothionein. It does dimerize. And so Chris took some pictures while he was at the MRC, and this is maltose binding protein with two metallothionines as concatenated. So it's maltose binding protein, metallothionein, metallothionein, made as a chimeric protein, and then labeled with gold. And you can see the gold. This is a frozen hydrated picture. You can actually see the gold. And he's got an antibody in here, so there's an antibody with two of these maltose binding proteins with metallothionein on them to make a sort of. You can see here some of them. You can see the labeling. So, but it still needs work. I mean, this isn't really something to write home about yet. So. Anyway, but it's something to think about, and something to think about improving. And the other thing I should say is that we've actually been able to label to get gold into bacteria so that we can tank up metallothionein with gold inside the bacterium, inside the native bacterium. So, and bacteria are much tougher to get things into probably than eukaryotic cells. So I think, you know, with some work it might be quite good. And it'll be a way of labeling, perhaps, in cells. So now we'll assume that. So one issue is to be able to label the proteins of interest. But as Richard was mentioning, there are also improvements to the equipment that we use. And I don't think I've covered all of them. I mean, Richard had some of them that I hadn't thought of. I just did this off the top of my head. They didn't tell me to work that hard. One of the things you'd really like, as Richard was mentioning, is a phase plate. And of course, you really don't want spherical aberration if you have a phase plate, because it works against you. And Richard again was mentioning you want a DQE of 1, that is, you want to detect every electron, and you want a modulation transfer function of 1 in a digital imaging system. That's what you'd like. Maybe you'd like an energy filter, or maybe not. I think people don't know. It's good for some things. You'd like a drift and vibration-free double tilt cryo holder. They exist. I don't know that they're always drift and vibration-free, but they do exist. So you'd like them better. Or the other thing you might like is a 360-degree cylindrical cryo holder, so you could twirl the specimen. So why do you want these things? Well, the phase plate with no spherical aberration, you know, when you take an image and you use defocus, you have this oscillating contrast transfer function in which you lose data, because the phase is only introduced in zones by the defocus. And if you had a phase plate with no spherical aberration, the contrast transfer function would be 1 everywhere, so that you would see every level of detail. If you have spherical aberration, what happens is the spherical aberration introduces a phase shift when you get out to higher resolution. So you wind up kind of screwing yourself. So you'd really like to, if you want the best of all these worlds, this is not a real plot. I just made this up. It looks something like that. So you know, you don't get paid for this. You get what you get paid for. If they'd given me a salary, I might have actually calculated it, but it was beyond what I was going to do. But the point is that if you have this, the amplitude variations leaving the specimen in this case would faithfully reflect the details in the structure at every level of detail. That's the goal, from very low resolution to high resolution. That's what you'd like, assuming your specimen is perfect, of course. So why do you want a DQE and a modulation transfer function of 1? Well, the electrons arriving at the image plane contain the information leaving the specimen. The recording system generally, I was going to put always, degrades that information. So you'd be much better off if you didn't record the image at all, because then the electrons are perfect. Once you put a piece of film, as Richard was saying, or some kind of detector, you really foul things up. So a DQE, the detector quantum efficiency, is the signal-to-noise ratio coming in versus the signal-to-noise ratio that comes out of your detection system. If it equals 1, it means that you recorded, as Richard was saying, every electron without introducing additional noise. That's what you want. A modulation transfer function means that your system records all the spatial frequencies that come from the sample. So that's what you want. Now, why aren't recorded images perfectly faithful? And again, I'll only repeat some of what Richard says. Electrons are like, you know, one of those crazy balls. If I took it, I thought about doing it, but then I thought it would terrify people. Take one of those crazy balls and bounce it around like that, and you're trying to figure out where it came from. And at every collision, an incoming electron generates secondary electrons, or J electrons, photons, and so on. So here's what actually happens. This is from a paper. This is from Wolfgang Werner's website. Here's your initial electron coming in, and Richard showed some examples on his recorder. It bounces around, creates secondary electrons, and then it leaves. So he showed some examples where you have interactions here and then interactions. Well, here's one that comes in, wanders around, and leaves again. So it can make quite a big spot and lose a lot of energy. And in fact, the electron loses most of its energy at the end of its run. So it's not when the electron enters, it loses energy uniformly. It loses a little bit to begin with, and then by the end of the run, it loses everything. So the kind of volume that these things carve out looks something like this. So here's an electron coming in. And when you look at all the events that go on, they all take place in some kind of tear-shaped volume inside the matter. And this is useful for SEM, where you want to know what kind of signal you get out, because they don't look at primary electrons. They look at secondary electrons or X-rays or something else, and this tells you where those signals come from. But the other point about it is that as the electron enters, it sort of wanders around in this volume and can actually leave. And this very early layer is where it loses the least of its energy. So the upshot of it is, if you use a very thin detector, all right, then, of course, you only record the electron exactly where it enters, because it disappears. You don't give it a chance to wander around. So you'd have a very high MTF, so your modulation transfer function, the electron would be very well localized from where it arrived. But of course, then you don't see. A lot of electrons pass through, and they don't lose any energy, so you lose them. So you get a very bad DQE. You can say, well, I'll make the detector thicker. And that's good. If you make it thick enough, of course, then the spot that you get, as Richard was showing, is very big. You get all of the energy. So you detect every electron, but the modulation transfer function is now terrible because, you know, the thing has made a huge spot. So, and of course, the higher the energy of the electron, the worse the problem. So if you're at 300 volts, it's much worse. So what is a possibility? Well, Ken Downing, who's not here, but will be, is constructing electron decelerator. And basically, here's your high voltage electron This is my schematic representation of this decelerator. But the idea is you make an image here at 300 kilovolts, and then you slow all the electrons down until they get to the camera, so you can slow them down as much as you want. So in that way, you increase both the DQE and the MTF, because the electrons with their low energy don't wander as much. So you get them more localized, and because they don't have much energy, it's all lost in a relatively thinner detector. So this may be something that will help out. And again, energy filters, they now exist on microscopes. And as Richard was saying, for every electron that does you some good, that's elastically scattered and provides information, around three don't. And they damage the specimen, and they also give rise to a noisy background, which isn't helpful. So because they've lost energy, you can think about filtering them out, or as Richard was saying, another possibility is to try and make a chromatic aberration so that they are imaged back properly into the specimen. But the energy filters exist, but they are not routinely used in high-resolution studies. People do use them for tomography to kind of clean up the image, but they're not routinely used, at least not as far as I know, and they haven't really been explored. So when I talk to people and ask them, do you turn your energy filter on? You're trying to get a 4-angstrom map, they say no. So I'm not sure why that is. I mean, I don't do this anymore. I'm retired, so I think. But it's something you should talk about. You should ask people, because they now build them right into the microscope, and I think they still work. A drift and vibration-free double tilt cryo holder. Well, you can't. What you want to do, Richard was saying, how do you know you have the right answer when you have a structure? Well, the answer is if you do tilting. I mean, that's 3D reconstruction actually arose out of thoughts about how do you know. People did model building earlier. They looked at a 2D image and then they built some three-dimensional structure that they thought represented the image, and there was always the question about how do you know that the model you built looking at a 2D just 2D images is right? And the answer is that Klug and Finch had put forward is by tilting. And I think that's a simple answer, the sort of general answer Richard was talking about, and I think the final answer has not really been worked out, and I think there's room there. But tilting is the way to prove your structure is right. And I think when you tilt it and you don't quite get the right answer back, there's an issue. I mean, it's sort of the ideal. If it behaved perfectly, that would be true. And it doesn't behave perfectly, what does that mean? Is it just error? Is it one image is bad? And so I think there's work there to be done on sort of verifying your answer. But anyway, you can't tilt by plus or minus 90 degrees. So you can only tilt up maybe to 60 or 70. And so the question is, if you tilt around one axis and then around a second axis, when you tilt around one axis, you're missing data in this direction, and it elongates structures this way. I think it's well known. If you tilt around two axes, this way and this way, you reduce the problem. And here's I've got this example made by Dave Mastronardi. I got it from Danny Nicastro. So here's a microtubule, and if you tilt the microtubule this way, that's this structure here by if you tilt it this way, that's 0 degrees. If the tilt axis is here and you rotate this to 45 degrees, it's not too bad. If the microtubule is right along the tilt axis, then you can see the image that you get. The three-dimensional reconstruction is very poor because, of course, no matter how you tilt it this way, you still get a line. So there's no way it can figure out that it's a round structure. So, in fact, the quality of a reconstruction of long tubular things depends on whether the tubular things are perpendicular to the y-axis, that's this, or right along it, in which case you get this. If you have a double tilt holder, this shows what happens when you have a single tilt holder. the quality of the elongation along the z-axis. If a single tilt holder and double tilt holder, you see you get pretty good resolution along the z-axis with a double tilt holder, and that's just the general property of them. So, the ideal thing would be if you had a holder that you could rotate by 360 degrees, because then you wouldn't lose any data. There wouldn't be any elongation in the axial direction. And people are now using ion milling beams. Here's an image from some work by Sriram Subramanian, and they use this milling device. It's a gadolinium beam to mill out a perfect cylindrical specimen. And of course, that would be very nice if you could do that in a frozen block and somehow transfer it into the microscope and just spin it around, and everything else were perfect, you could get a full 360-degree data set. Of course, you'll fry your specimen doing it, but that's Richard's problem, not mine. Just telling you what you can do. He'll explain how you can not do that. So what else do we need to explore in order to get better images and extract all the data from the electron microscope? Well, at what electron dose and dose rate do we get the best signal-to-noise ratio? Richard was mentioning 5 electrons per square angstrom. And I know he had done some experiments. Is it that the first 3 electrons give you a lot of data and the last 2 don't? Or the first 3 are bad and the last 2 are good? I don't think we really know the answer to that. And early on, some work that Richard and Nigel did suggested that the dose rate didn't really matter. But Niko Grigoryev and James Chen have recently experiments showing that low dose, that is, if you have a much longer exposure on the order of collecting your data over a 5-second exposure or a 10-second exposure instead of a 1-second exposure, produces less damage to the specimen. So maybe we haven't really figured out the answer to everything about what dose and what dose rate are really best. What's the best cryotemperature to use? There's still some debate about whether liquid helium is better than liquid nitrogen if you have single particles, so, or something in between. And the other thing that is important is in the image, we have a lot of different electrons contributing. You have the elastic ones, which those are the ones you want. There are quasi-elastically ones, that is, ones that lose energy delocalized, so they actually give rise to an image. And then you have inelastically scattered ones over the solid angle that you collect data in. And we don't really know. We don't really have the understanding of that image in detail. And I'll get back to that. The reason we want to know that if we're trying to determine a model or a map from a set of images, we should really fit it to the recorded original images and not the images after you've taken away the inelastic scattering. I mean, ideally, that's what you'd want to do. You want to account for everything in the image and not just the part after you've sort of gotten rid of some of the background and fitted it. I mean, ideally, that's the best information that you have, and anything else you do is getting rid of information. So you're not making use of everything that's there. I think Richard's point about the corrector, using a corrector so you can image those inelastic electrons, example of that. And we don't understand the images well enough to do that. What can be done to improve image analysis? Resolution, as Richard was saying, seems to be improving with time. And at least part of it's due to better image analysis, the better alignment, better CTF determination, and better reconstruction algorithms. And so let's think about alignment for a minute. You're trying to determine the alignment of a particle, so you know the particle's in a particular orientation. And often in the face of potential variations in conformation, and probably other things. So if you don't get the alignment right, or if you have variation in conformation, what you're doing is you're turning signal into noise. That is, you're putting the signal in incorrectly. And you're actually, in a way, adding noise. Not real noise, but it's turning it into noise. So what can you do about variations in particle conformation? Well, the people have thought of two things. One is you classify a field of single particles, and then you sort them looking for conformational variations. People have done that. And that's certainly one possibility. And one of the questions that Richard brought up and that we all think about, are there bad images or are there only variations in conformation or both? And I think one of the things about damage, when you damage particles, is that some particles escape damage and others get creamed. So when you have a field of particles, they aren't all damaged after exposure to the same extent. And some of them may be damaged very early. That's a possibility. Some may have conformational variability. Some may have pieces of ice over them. We don't actually know the answer to what's wrong with bad images. And it may be important. The other possibility is if you could predict conformations, if you had a crude starting model, and you could predict conformations, say, using normal mode analysis or something, and use those as reference images, you might be able to, you know, sort images. And I think that's an area for some investigation for you young people to do something. So after I get done with this, I want you to get up and start doing something. Eat, I hope. And the other question is, how small are the variations that we can detect given the inherent signal to noise? That's also an important question that Richard touched on a bit. How do you know when a structure is different? What's the level? And I think we have some ideas about that, but we need some really practical data. Better CTF correction. I mean, here's this actually took. But, you know, you're out using data out here, and you have to guess. Remember, every time you go through one of these zeros, you have to change the phase that you add in. So by the time you're out here, you want to know exactly whether you're going through the contrast transfer function. And if you don't get that right, you again, you put things in with the wrong phase. So again, you're ruining your data. And also, there's a correction for depth of field. I mean, you assume that the depth of field is infinite. It's not if your structure is big enough. And if you don't take that into account, you add in the wrong amplitude and worse, the wrong phase. And I think one of the things that Richard always said that was very useful, he said, you should build it into your program and get it working. Then you don't have to think about it anymore. It just does it. Reconstruction algorithms, people argue about them. And is maximum likelihood, as proposed by Fred Sigrith, who's right back over there, really the best, and is it practical? And in this method, all the images that you have are added in all orientations into the final reconstruction, which sounds sort of crazy. But they're weighted according to the probability that it's right. And this is very important. So, you know, when you're looking, you know you're looking down on a view, you're looking down on this pen. But there's also a probability that you're really looking at it this way. So, but the probability may be very close to zero. But you don't want to leave that chance out because you don't actually know, as Richard was saying, plus or minus 2.5 degrees, when the particle is tilted, you don't know whether it's exactly right. So you want to add in all those possibilities. This is very computational intensive. So the question is, you know, is that really the best we can do? What should you do when you're doing this if you have an image that you get a sort of, you know, you have a virus or something? So you get the center of mass right. But when you look at the orientational parameters at high resolution, you don't find them. It doesn't show a peak. So you don't have a probability. It's uniform. What should you do with a particle like that? Eliminate it? Put it in? I think nobody knows the answer to that. How should you generate the final map? Now, there's evidence that if you select particles, so Keiichi Namba's map had 50,000 asymmetric units in the final map. Now, he just didn't take, these were for the bacterial flagellar filament, which is a particle. Now, he didn't take exactly 50,000, the first 50,000 images. He probably took, you know, many, many more times of that, and he selected them. So he threw out ones that he didn't think were good. So what is the question? Should you wait? If you were doing an average and you had data with varying variance, what you should do is add them all in. They should be variance weighted and maybe probability weighted. So, or is that the right thing to do? And or should you just throw out the bad particles, have some kind of cutoff? I don't think we know the answer to that question. And what sort of is the best method for generating a map? Back projection, CERT, which is an iterative, free align, some kind of wavelets, matrix inverse. All of those are possibilities. And I don't think we know the best. So I think that should generate some discussion. And as I said before, ideally you'd want to have a reconstruction that satisfies the original images with all those electrons and all the different kinds of electrons. But the question you might ask, is it worth it? You know, I was once talking to Sidney Brenner, who is a source of great wit, and I was saying about a way to purify a protein, and I guess it was a little bit over the top, and he said, you know, that's like taking a bath in triple distilled water to be really clean. And so I think, you know, this might be the right thing to think about, but it might not be worth the effort. So it might be like taking a bath. But you do want to understand the noise, because a lot of these algorithms depend on Gaussian distributed noise. But it isn't. And it may be important in terms of optimizing the algorithm. And for tomograms, you want optical strategies for sorting, classifying, and aligning them. And I think that requires, that's people have started to do it. But I think there's a lot of room for improvement. And by doing it, you can, of course, increase the resolution, as Richard had pointed out. And Danny Nicastro actually could show in the eukaryotic flagellum that she could see dynes in different conformations by aligning and averaging them. So I think there's a lot of room for improvement there. Now, assuming you have the best map, you want an atomic model, if the resolution warrants it. And, you know, people haven't really done this. I mean, people build atomic models, they dock something in, they remodel it a bit. But there are other things you could think of. Is it possible that at lower resolution, you could actually define a fold, and then you could use something like threading and remodeling to generate an atomic model? I think those are things that people might be able to do with less than ideal resolution. And, you know, I think these are things to think about for the future, maybe not to talk about here, but people now do docking with conformational adjustments to fit the EM map. The question is, how good are those? Do you get an accurate model? And how does a resolution affect the accuracy? It's certainly true in crystallography. If you have a 3.5 angstrom map generated of a protein and a 0.9 angstrom map, the accuracy is much better in the 0.9 angstrom map. And those RMS deviations of the atoms are, in fact, quantifiable. And I think people don't really talk about that much. They're very happy to have anything. And in particular, the inter-domain interfaces. So you're docking something that you assume it's relatively rigid, and you're adjusting domains generally relative to each other, and you have an interface. And there are plenty of docked models, but no attempt to find out if the actual interfaces are, in fact, accurate. So you really want experiments to test the models, and you want to think of ways, and maybe solid-state NMR is one. Although now liquid NMR is capable of actually, solution NMR is capable of going up to quite high molecular weight, so you may be able to test it by NMR, for instance. I'm assuming you can't get an X-ray structure, otherwise you probably wouldn't be doing this. And finally, I wanted to just say that we actually need to automate everything, as I was saying before. And so here is what how I think automation ought to go. So I picked Bridget because she was, of course, the queen of automation. So ideally, this is what would happen, right? And Bridget, of course, replies. Of course, and as a sample, notice I made the sample very tiny, 10 microliters at 2 mg per mil. I thought that was, you know, as long as you're going to dream, might as well dream big. So the model said, thank you, Bridget. Your map should be ready just after your afternoon nap. And, of course, Bridget is very complimentary. Looks for a copy of the New York Times. I mean, as long as you have an automation, there's no reason you have to, you know, you can't read the New York Times. So what happens in the automation? Well, as Bridget is setting up to do, the robot shows up with a sample, puts it into the automated does-it-all black box that takes care of all the problems that Richard has talked about. And, of course, first it plunges the specimen perfectly in the perfect grid. It loads it into the perfect double tilt holder that takes a complete 3D data set. It puts it in the microscope, collects all the images. They all come into the computer automatically, and of course the structures, the atomic model is built. There it is. And then of course the robot, I always like bouncy robots, you know, they should be lively. So it shows up with a 2D structure, bounces in, and of course wakes Bridget up from her afternoon nap, saying, here's the atomic model of the structure. Bridget loves it, it's beautiful. And of course the robot, being a well-programmed, says yes, says she's going to become famous, and asks would she like her glass of champagne in the afternoon. And she says, of course, I'll have the Dom Perignon. No, these guys are well-funded, so of course they can afford. And then she wants to know, has the robot written the paper so she can submit it to Sal? So, although we've come a long way, there's lots of work needed to have a more productive future. And of course, in the words of the great American philosopher Yogi Berra, says the future ain't what it used to be. We hope it's better. But I finally want to end with Ken Downing told me particularly, was part of a discussion panel, wants you to tell him what is your rate limiting step. So I promised I would do that. He's not here. So all of you have to write down what your rate limiting step is. And then you leave them right here. Bridget and Ron will collect them and give them to Ken. Anyway, thanks.